welcome back to Extra Features Enemy. Today we have Joe Gafassi, which I don't know why he's back. This is like his fourth film, and this is his first film. So I have a lot of questions he doesn't even know about. My first question is, before we even start, how have you been?
I've been good. I've been really busy. We're, a friend of mine, Marcus Vasquez, is doing a Batman fan film, and he asked me to play the Joker, which was a dream. And we've been spending a lot of time with that. We're almost finished. And I've been working to get the Lars the Emo Kid Blu-ray and DVDs ready.
I saw that.
That's been pretty time-consuming. But they're almost done. The DVD's done, ready to go to press. I'm having some trouble with the Blu-ray. I should iron all that out next week.
I guess my first question, before you start discussing your film, what happened to your hair?
What do you mean?
It's Laughing Boy, you have this crazy hair happening.
That was 20 years ago.
It was 28 years ago, I think. It was 1990 with Laughing Boy, right?
98.
Okay, so 20 years ago, you had this, like, crazy hair.
More hair and less gray.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. Now, before I want to get into the film, don't worry. Your editing style. What was going on with Laughing Boy?
What do you mean? That was my first. Laughing Boy was my first feature film as a director. I did the rough cut myself, and then John Grimion, who actually did the final edit, basically just tweaked a little bit of what I did. We didn't spend too much time fixing it. It's kind of old school.
Yeah.
Kind of the slow pacing, but I think, that's what are your thoughts on it?
Your editing is awful, Joe. I have to have everyone, your editing is terrible. Terrible. It's just like, what? What's going on? It's just, you're so seamless now in watching Dead of Night or Lars the Real, like, they're very seamless edits.
Thank you. It was my first one,
brutal.
I was just excited to be getting through it, and you know, when you do your first film, you don't see a lot of the mistakes. You're just so excited about it, and you think everything's brilliant, and you can't recognize your own mistakes. That's really the explanation. Some people like it, some people don't, and that's okay. I looking back, yeah, it could have been a lot better.
So have you gone back to revisit this film ever?
I thought about going back and cutting a shorter version, making it like 30 minutes to put online, but I just thought I'm just going to leave it alone.
I don't want you to cut the film. I like the film.
I don't, you know, I can't go back and re-edit it because the hard drive that all the, first of all, it's 20 years old, and the hard drive that all the editing projects were on crashed, and it was an old, oh gosh, I don't even remember what kind of editing software I use. I think it was called an EMC. My friend Bill Moore, who had a post-production company here in Houston years ago, just let me borrow an old machine and take it home and edit from home. So we didn't have the luxury that we do now where editing, everyone has an editor on their Mac. I had to use a special computer dedicated to that, which is probably long gone. So there's no going back and fixing anything.
In watching Laughing Boy, I gotta tell you, it's so weird seeing you act. I've never seen you act.
I was not my first choice for that. You know, having been an actor in these low budget things for a few years before doing that, I knew that I was gonna be there every day. Because I've been on other films where actors have quit when things have fallen apart. And I did audition some actors for that role of Cody, and only one guy was real. The one guy that I really wanted to consider, his name was Spike Spencer. He would have just knocked it out of the park. But at the time was a really in demand local actor, so I couldn't have afford him or take him away from other opportunities, which would have held the film up. So I knew I was going to be there every day. It started out as a weekends only thing, which was even more important that I had reliable people. So that was the thought process there. I haven't acted in my own films since because I've operated my own camera on the next three. My friend, at the time, he wasn't my friend, but he became my friend during the shoot. Hassan Naji is the guy that shot Laughing Boy. He brought a grip truck, and he shot 16mm film, which I understand shooting on film. I had never done it, and I'm not about to learn how on a feature film like that, because I used my own money, too, like $35,000 to make that film, Laughing Boy, using 16mm film, compared to the next film, Dead of Night, which was $2,300 and a better film.
I won't say it's a better film. It's a different film. I find all your films are different.
Yes, thank you for noticing that. I think I've developed certain things that people identify in my film, so that's a typical Joe Grisafi. But yes, I do think everything I've done is different. And I love that because I know a lot of filmmakers will try to mimic their heroes, Kubrick, Coppola, whoever it might be. And I don't find myself doing that. I find myself experimenting a little bit, but finding what is best for this moment in the film, not necessarily trying to mimic what someone else did. Sometimes it's clear that another filmmaker's influence has affected what I do, but I never set out to say, I want this to look like this shot in this really popular film. I don't think I've ever done that.
I don't think you have either, and I've seen all your films, and I study them pretty heavily. I would say, no, you. What is your style? I've seen four different films from you, and I can't tell you what your style is.
Which is not as jokes and things that I put in there.
Yeah, but Laughing Boy is nothing like Conjoined or Lars and the Emo Kid. Like, they're nothing similar.
Right, and, you know, another thing to know about Laughing Boy, this is the history of how I developed that. I was studying a lot of independent films that were popular at the time that were big successes, you know, Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It, Clerks, and all those films that influenced my decision to actually finally do it. I had also been hearing a lot at the time about Dove Simmons' workshops about how to make a movie for $5,000. So I went to one of his free workshops at a convention and read about him online and got the gist of what he was talking about. Find a script that takes place in one location. That was really the key thing. So I took that information and reached out to my friend George Douglas Lee, who was a playwright, still is a playwright. And he had given me this script, Laughing Boy, years before. And it was a stage play. And I thought, and that's one of the Dove Simmons suggested, find a stage play that you can adapt into a film. So I called George and said, hey, do you still have a copy of that Laughing Boy? Can you send it to me? And I read it. I thought it was funny. And it was all, the whole thing takes place at one house, as you know. So I thought, okay, this is funny. It takes place in one house. This is what I'm going to do. So that's kind of the history of how it came to be. It's something that I was capable of doing in one location. We opened it up. We added the first house and then the stuff at the golf course. That was all in the script, but not – it was all on stage, obviously, in the play.
So where does the Sublime reference come in? Is that you throwing that in or is that the playwright?
I threw that in just because it was a popular song at the time. And – that's the gist of the movie.
It is.
Life's too short to love the one you got. Yeah. Because he's in love with his boss. He thinks he's in love with his boss when he's got this great wife. So, and that song was popular at the time, so I thought it would be a nice little thing to put at the top because some filmmakers use pretentious quotes in their movies, and I thought, okay, that's not pretentious. That's kind of funny.
So
Life's too short to love the one you got. Because you might get run over or you might get shot.
Yes, it's a great thought. my question is, before I am, now you mentioned Clerks. Yes, I can see a lot of Clerks in here.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about it because I was trying to think of it last night. I go, this reminds me of something, and I couldn't think of what it was, and Clerks is exactly it.
At the time we were screening it, it did pretty well at film festivals, the lower end film festivals. It screened a lot. But then again, at the time, it was a lot more difficult to make a film. It was digital video was just coming to be, and it still looked like video. So I didn't want to, I wanted my first film to be on film. At the time, people would tell me, ask if I had seen Peter Sellers' The Party. And I still have not. They said it reminded them a lot of Peter Sellers' The Party.
No.
No?
I've seen Peter Sellers' The Party. I like your film better. I do not like The Party.
Thank you.
It takes a long time to get going. And the second half of The Party is phenomenal.
But I still want to see it. It still kind of gets my interest.
The first half of The Party is a little rough. Now, this is something we've never discussed because it never came up when we first started interviewing, I guess a year ago now.
Yeah.
How do you feel about indie films and screening? I'm coming more and more to the point that when you send a film to the film festival, they get money from you automatically, right? Let's say $50 right. For the sake of my argument, and they say no. But they take another film. So they're up $100 in my world. How does that make you feel?
It really bothered me at first. I think for Laughing Boy, I spent like $3,000 in festival fees. And we got accepted to quite a few. There were some surprises, like the big local festival turned it down. And that was a $90 entry fee. You got to be careful. And not submit to just any festival unless you just don't care about burning money. Back then it was exciting. This is my first film. I'm going to submit it to everything I can. And I ended up, like I said, spending $3,000. Dead of Night, I didn't spend any money on festivals. It played like two or three that it was invited to without me having to pay. And then Lars the Emo Kid, the Conjoined came. We shot Lars the Emo Kid. And before I finished it, we shot and finished Conjoined. So Conjoined, I spent maybe I paid for two entry fees, but I discovered Film Freeway, which is this database, like Without a Box, but it also has an option to select only festivals that don't charge anything. And there are actually a bunch of festivals that don't charge any entry fee all over the world. And I concentrated on those. I didn't go after any big ones like Sundance or Slam Dance. With Conjoined, I just went after the freebies and maybe paid twice. I paid for the Fantastic Horror Film Festival in San Diego, which it got accepted for, and another one, which I don't recall, but it was only like a $10 fee. And Conjoined has played like 30, 35 places around the world. Laughing Boy may have played 8 to 10 festivals. And looking back, that was a lot of money to waste, but it's just part of the game. Either you buck up and you pay it, or you just don't pay it and don't do festivals. A lot of filmmakers aren't doing festivals at all.
I don't know. This is why I'm asking you. What would you suggest a filmmaker? You made a lot of films. Would you suggest just putting your film on Amazon or a streaming service and skip the film festival route, or go that way?
It's hard to say just skip the film festival route, although a lot of filmmakers do. If you've got – I've never had the luxury of having the budget to hire a star. So it's harder for me to get proper distribution for my films because it's just basically my friends who happen to be very talented actors, fortunately. But as far as festivals go, I would say be careful. Do your homework. Don't just submit to every festival. If it's free, submit. As regarding Amazon, you got to think about that early because – Amazon is accessible to all filmmakers now. Everyone can put their film on Amazon Video and Amazon Prime. Many film festivals will not accept your film if you do that because technically your film is now publicly available in distribution. I submitted Conjoined to one festival per request of the programmer, paid my fee, and Conjoined was already out on DVD myself and on Amazon, and then he realized that there was no secret. I didn't hide it from him. And he said, you know, it's in distribution. Our rules really say you can't do that. So he refunded my fee too, which he didn't really have to do. But you got to be careful. Read the festivals you're after, the festivals you want to play at, be sure you read their rules. And if they have a no films in distribution rule, then if you want to play that festival, you can't be on Amazon. You can't be on YouTube. You can't be on Vimeo. You can't have your film publicly accessible. My experience with the film festivals is even going, this is a lesson I took from Laughing Boy. I traveled with the film. Every out of town festival that played at, I went, which was of course very expensive as well. The lesson I learned from that was I didn't have anything to leave behind after that festival was over, and I didn't have a release date. So all these people that got excited about Laughing Boy at these festivals, I didn't have anything to tell them. You know, I couldn't say, oh, if you like it, go tell your friend they can find it on DVD or it's streaming at this site. And it was maybe 2 years until 2 years after this festival life that it got real distribution, and those people didn't care anymore. They moved on to whatever film was hot for that they were enjoying at the time. So it's hard to get those people back. And that's a lesson I tried to take with Conjoined is I'm not going to worry about the film festivals. I'm going to worry about getting product out to people. And if I can play some festivals, great. So when we did start to get festivals that I could afford to go to the festival, I had product. I had DVDs. One great example is Texas Frightmare Weekend with Conjoined. We got invited to screen the film, and I had DVDs. That was like the world premiere of the DVD. So after the screening of Conjoined, which was a full house, we went back to our table, and there was already a line of people waiting to buy the DVD versus having a screening of Laughing Boy and everyone saying, oh, we love it. It was so great. When can we get it? I don't know. Because I was so excited about doing my first film. I thought this is going to be great. These people love it. I'm going to get real distribution. I'm going to get discovered. And it didn't happen, which is a very common story.
See, I'm killing it. I'm pounding you with different questions. See the difference that your makes?
And you know, let me tell you, I respect and I love the fact that you can sit here and tell me that you did not like the editing. I love that. And I'm mature enough as a filmmaker now to accept and that's your opinion. And I can learn from that. And I can listen to you and have a civil conversation about it. I've seen other filmmakers really get upset when people criticize their films honestly. And like, do you know how hard it was to do? Do you know how much money I put into that film? It doesn't matter. This is my opinion. So I respect that and thank you for your honesty.
Well, I think as friends, you'd be upset if I didn't say something I didn't like.
Yes. Yes, I really want people at this point in my career, and it's been years that I've felt this way, be honest. If you don't like something I've done, it is okay. The truth is, any criticism anyone has given of my films, I probably agree with it. It's just, I don't worry about it. I can't go back and fix it, but I probably agree with it. That's with every film I've done. Someone says, I didn't really care for this part. Well, you know, I knew someone would say that. And there are problems there. But sometimes you got to just finally let go and release the film.
Yeah, I'm with you. No, I think just sort of to go back to that, we're friends. And I think we've done enough of these interviews. I can talk to you differently than I talk to other people.
But and we should be able to talk to other people too.
I do. I criticize other people's editing. And he thanked me for it, actually, in an interview. I said, your editing on that scene's wrong. He goes, oh, thanks. And he went back and looked at it, and he thanked me for apologizing. I found the mistake, and I told him where it was.
Good, and hopefully that was a chance for him to go back and fix it if the film wasn't finished.
I never did ask him if he fixed it. I presume he did, because he said all his extras left, and I said, well, you can tell in the room there's nobody there. He goes, right. I'll crop it a little bit more.
Right.
So
yeah, that's a problem, too.
Okay, I've got one more question that we're going into your film, I promise, because I do want to discuss this. Why Starship Films?
I just like the name. There's an old arcade game called Starship by Atari that I kind of thought about when I named it. And I thought Starship Films was a nice little name. And I've got the LLC in Texas. I don't think anyone in the country has it. So, and I got the website. So guys, Starship Films is mine. Oh. I started with Starship Comics. I was going to try to, after Laughing Boy, I was trying to launch a comic book, but I knew nothing about that. And now I do, and I still have hopes to launch that comic book. But I thought Starship Comics was a great name for a comic book company.
Oh, I agree.
Even though I don't do any science fiction stuff, I was writing a science fiction film at the time. It was a kind of an homage, a love letter to 80s arcade games, which if I release it now, it won't be as big a deal because everyone, you know, there's Ready Player One and there was Wreck-It Ralph and Pixels. So the arcade thing has been done, so I'd have to find a different gimmick for my story if I ever get that off the ground. But yeah, I thought Starship Films and Starship Comics was a nice little name, unpretentious and memorable.
Well, you know I love to discuss locations. You know that for a fact. It's my favorite thing to discuss, besides catering. Now, you use two different houses, correct? I would say yes.
Correct.
That first house had a very distinct look, I thought. Like it had a bathtub in the closet almost, it was really weird.
That was my brother's house. I knew the two people whose houses I used. That was my brother's house. He doesn't live there anymore. That's been a long time ago. But yeah, his bathroom was huge and it had a hot tub. It was a big bathtub in the smack in the middle of the bathroom.
Yeah.
So you had to walk around, you know, the scene where we're coming out of the bathroom, we walk over the tub. We're at the sink, and we walk into the bedroom by stepping over the tub. So it's like this giant bathroom with the tub in the middle of the room, and then the shower off to the corner. And it was a normal size house. It was just a regular 3-bedroom house in a small neighborhood, but the bathroom was unusually large for what the house was.
Oh, that's strange. Now, when you're in your bedroom getting dressed with Anne Quackenbush, who I love, by the way, you know I do, so.
Yes.
She was wonderful. You go under the bed is the shot. You know exactly what shot I want to go to.
Yes.
Where's all the stuff coming from?
It's just to show that he's still a little boy.
Okay, because I didn't.
And you know, the house is relatively clean except for some toys when he comes in, but then there's under the bed, there was a Playboy magazine, the Light Bright. If you notice, said Save Ferris.
Yeah, I did notice that. I did notice.
And some other toys. That's all it was. It's just he's a little boy. He keeps his toys under his bed.
Yeah, but how come he didn't wear the Joe Grafassi shirt with the milk?
That was a last-minute thing. We had already shot the main portion of the party. We had already shot the party when we went to shoot the opening. So Billy McTavish, one of the crew members, the gaffer, had made these shirts, and I decided to add the shirt to the scene. So that was just like, oh, we got this. Let's make a joke out of it.
Oh, it was a good joke.
Good. Because the joke was I was milking every shot at the
Okay. You were, actually. You know what? That does make perfect sense. That does make a lot of sense. I made a note. Does Cody like his wife? Or no?
Oh, yes. I would say they're best friends.
Because you don't get that from the beginning of the film.
But that's, we want to set up.
The end of the film. Correct. I got that.
If he liked her, he doesn't dislike her. He's just kind of, he doesn't want to go to this party, so he's a little irritable. But if we have them really liking each other at the beginning, then the payoff doesn't really work.
Yeah, I can see that now, but I'm making notes as I watch.
We never discussed how long they've been married, but I can see how people just like, oh, come on, they're in their routine.
Now, you're saying you don't discuss how long they're married, but they do have a kid that's 5.
Yes.
So I think
we don't know if the 5-year-old was in wedlock or if they had been married 2 or 3 years before. We never really established that because it didn't seem to be too important for the story other than.
Well, I have to disagree with you because the script says that at one point, Joe's talking to Edwina and says, my wife told me it was time for me to become a dad. So
you know what? You're right. It's been a long time. You're right. You're absolutely right.
So I would argue he does know. He's married. I'd say he is married before they have the kid.
Yeah, you're right. That's a detail that I forgot after all these years. But you're right. When he's talking to Duena, who's played by my friend Tiffany Grant, he does say, my wife decided it was time we had a kid, and I think it's the best choice that I've made yet, or something to that effect. Yes, you are correct.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I guess the kid was not needed. Like, did you have a kid cast? Were you ever going
to
show the kid?
No, we never. We thought it would be too much trouble to have to mess with a child actor because in the play, you're not going to have a kid. We just thought it was better to not involve a child.
Oh, I agree with you. I don't think he's needed.
Because, you know, when you involve children on your set, you have to have parents or a supervisor. And technically, if you're shooting on a school day, you have to have the state law says you got to have a teacher, an on-set teacher, which drives your cost up. And I thought, let's just leave the kid off camera.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Jeff Walton's music choices are different or strange?
I think he did a really good job. We wanted it to be very cartoony. And most of the background music, anything that was not composition, was a friend of Jeff's. His name was Mark Deeney, and he contributed a CD to us that we could pull all these background tracks from. So Jeff wrote the theme song.
Yeah, which is fine.
Anything with the cartoons, which obviously we wanted cartoony music.
Okay, that's not what I'm I'm talking about the other music then. It was the guy off the CD then.
Okay, yeah, anything that's playing background in the party, ambient music, that's not Jeff's work.
Okay. Then Jeff's off the hook.
Jeff's off, yes, but share your thoughts because
It took me out of the movie both times it showed up that I noticed it, and it was both
really?
At the beginning.
Do you remember which moment?
Yeah, I made a note how young you are, and Jeff Walton's music is very strange. So it must have been just before you went to the party. And you played again at the party, because I wrote Strange Music is Back.
Okay, it's all coming back to me now. The movie opens up with a track from The Dead Monkeys.
Okay, that must have been at the track.
That's the car. Then in the bedroom, we have a piece from The Strange Ways, which is kind of a ska band.
Yes, that's the one.
They were Corporate Monkey.
The name of the song
was Corporate Monkey.
Threw me off completely. Took me out.
Interesting, because no one's ever said that. These are guys I found at the last minute, and Toehead is also in there.
I love Toehead. They're fine.
Yeah, he gave me the song "I've Got Religion" that we used at the end, which I thought is just really
that works.
Great.
No, that one works.
All of these guys I found at the last minute. The movie was done. I needed music, and I got on the internet and started looking around, and I found Toehead and Strange Ways and the Dead Monkeys, and they all said yes. And I thought the Corporate Monkey, just because of the name of the song, I'm going to use this. So I didn't really think of how it was going to. I thought it was fine, and I thought if people hear the Corporate Monkey name in the song, it might register what we're doing. But interesting, no one's ever said that.
Maybe it's because it's my hearing. I do notice music a lot, and I do pay attention to music, and I'm always interested how directors work into music, into their stuff, and I always want to know why. I hear it a lot in feature films, too. I'm like, oh, here comes the song, because I know what's coming.
Yeah, so we didn't shoot or edit the film with any particular song in mind, with the exception of the televangelist song.
Yes, which I do want to talk about. Don't worry.
That's obviously the only one we knew we were going to incorporate into it.
Okay.
So other than that, the other songs were afterthoughts.
Okay, let's go with the televangelist song. Let's lead into that. We can jump around. Where did you find these people?
Robin Craig is a dear friend of mine. She plays Mary Jo Wagstaff, the televangelist. And at the time, I did not realize she was also an actor. I knew her as a casting director because that's how I met her. We met working in the extras casting department of the film Tin Cup in, what was that, 1994 or so? 94. We became friends there because we worked for like 2 months straight without a day off. And after Tin Cup wrapped, we stayed in touch, became good friends, and I knew her working as a casting director. So I decided I'm going to make this film. And I call her up and say, Robin, can you help me find someone to play the evangelist? I've got everyone else, access to all the other roles. I just can't find this person. And I sent her the script. And like 3 or 4 or 5 days later, she called me up and said, hey, what about me? And I said, you know what? Sure, let's audition you. Let's try you out. And I went to her house and she read some scenes and then she performed the song for me as an audition. That scene was not like that. And when she did this little song, I thought, well, that's just too good. Let's see if we can get the rights to that song. And we did. And she was the only person I read for that role because there was no reason to look elsewhere.
Okay. And she had
that's how she came about.
And her friend was perfect. The other woman that's with her?
Tammy Brown.
Was awesome. Yeah. I thought they were, like, perfect.
They were great. And I found Tammy after we decided to cast Robin.
Okay.
I put out a casting call, and Tammy popped up, and I said, perfect. We added that role. It's a small role, but we added, gave her a couple lines, and just, we want this team.
And what was up with her hair?
We wanted their hair to be as big as possible.
You couldn't get that hair any bigger.
That was a wig, and we wanted it to
be. Oh, that was a wig.
Yeah, that was a wig.
Didn't notice.
Good. Yeah, we wanted it to be a big Southern Bible Belt televangelist, and they all have heavy makeup and big hair down here.
I know, and it made me laugh. I go, Tammy Faye Baker's back. I go, it's perfect. It worked really well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I thought you did a really good job. Where did you find Anne Quackenbush is what I want to know, because she's a gem.
Oh, yeah, she's obviously an actress here in Houston. I don't recall exactly how we met. It may have been, we had the same talent agent, Michael Young at Sherry Young Mad Hatter, so I'm pretty sure that's how. And Anne she was very heavily into the theater scene here in Houston. So she's one of the big, at the time was one of the most in demand stage actresses in town. But she auditioned and obviously did a great job. I don't recall who else auditioned for that role. She may have been the only one. I may have called her directly and said, hey, do you want to do this? And she was just a delight to work with because obviously she, aside from me, she had the most screen time. And she had to be on set more than any of the other actors. Everyone else was there for the 5 or 6 days of the party, but Anne had to come back and actually come back twice. We shot the opening. We reshot the opening and to simplify it. But there were some mistakes. So she had to spend a lot of time with it, and she was absolutely professional about it, always happy to be there, no matter how long she needed to be on a particular day. There was one day that was ridiculously long because I was understaffed and just didn't know how to handle that particular day. It was like 18 hours long, and she was there the whole time without complaining. And I've never done a day like that to my cast ever again in the rest of the entirety of my career since then. But she's a delight, and obviously we used her in Dead of Night and Lars the Emo Kid. I wish there was something I could have added her to for Conjoined, but there's not. But she's always going to be considered for anything I do. Her and Sarah Gaston and Tiffany Grant are like the three that I want to take along for the ride. And anyone else I can reuse, I will. But they're the three that have been used in my films the most repetitively.
I know.
Yeah, and they're just such solid actors and good people.
So I have a weird picky thing with you, and I know you're going to think this is funny in my quirks. The husband burns the Cornish heads.
Yes, I know where you're going with this.
Who eats Cornish heads in a dinner party?
I just thought it was funny. And, you know, there's a mistake there. The little, I don't know what you call them, but the little paper things that go on the legs, those should have been burnt too.
Yes.
And it just didn't dawn on me to burn them, to singe them. But yeah, it just seemed like something that was funny.
It was funny.
Cornish hens are funny. Who eats them? Yeah, right. Who actually eats them? But they're funny.
They're terrible.
And I think that was written in the play.
Oh, awful.
I think, George, if I recall correctly, there's no reason I would have said, hey, Cornish hens are funny. I think that was in the original play.
Okay.
And in the bit, and then I thought, where do I find Cornish hens? That is funny. And to have the, make them a running gag. The running gag we got to do in the film. I don't think the gag was in the play.
Okay. I do have a funny quirk for you. You don't show any other food in this party.
There's some food at the table in the kitchen, but we don't highlight it.
You show the Cornish hens again on one shot.
Yes.
And I was looking for it. There's no food ever at this party.
If I recall, there's a table in the dining area.
Yes, where the Cornish hens sit. You put the burnt Cornish hens on it.
Okay.
And then they're always getting liquor. And you always show the liquor pile. But you never show food. I'm like, this is the weirdest party I've ever seen.
Because I guess the food wasn't important. The liquor was. And here's a thing about the liquor, too. I don't drink liquor, so I didn't have a bunch of bottles laying around. I went to a bar and got all the bottles. And if you go back and watch, all the bottles have a little sticker on it. This is the TABC, Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission.
I wouldn't have noticed that. I wouldn't have never clued
in. One or two people in the past have said, oh, I saw your TABC stickers on the bottles.
Sorry, I couldn't help you on that one.
There's no reason you would have noticed, but now if you go back and you see them,
bars
have to put that on there.
Do you think Cody's a real jerk at the party on purpose? Because he hates these people.
He went there to be a jerk on purpose. That was, he was entertaining himself and nobody else.
Well, his buddy likes him, finds him funny.
Well, we all have had that friend. Mike likes him, but Mike spends time with him outside of work too.
Yeah.
So he knows the real person.
Because, I mean, I think Cody's a jerk, and I'm like, wow, Joe's a real jerk in this movie.
Well, it was, George told me he wrote the play after he actually went to that party.
Hold on. This is based on a real party.
Apparently, this is based on a real event, a real party that George Lee went to. And he was infatuated with his boss, and that's George. If you knew George... George, anywhere he goes, he's like a low-budget Robin Williams. He's always on, and he's always trying to entertain himself. And some people love it, and some people find it really annoying. And, you know, some people find it endearing, like Michael did in the film. And so that's based on George. That's kind of autobiographical.
Okay. So let's go back to then based on things. The two guys want Cody to be thrown out.
Yes.
So they go to see the Queen, which I like that scene. I thought that scene really worked.
Good.
And I thought that was kind of funny. So, I mean, the Queen likes him too. She even states, no, he's okay. He's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Now, how did you shoot the Queen scene? Because that looks like a shot in the golf course.
It was. Spoiler alert. That's part of the joke. In the play, that scene was not styled as a medieval scene. It was not, the dialogue was not medieval in style. I asked George to rewrite the scene and, you know, just translate everything to Middle Earth, to Renaissance times. Make it sound medieval. Because I want to get out of the house. The scene's kind of redundant. We know what these guys want. So if we kept it in the house at the party, it would kind of be kind of dull. So I said, I want to shoot at that was the Malibu Castle golf course in Houston. It's no longer there.
Oh, see, I'm upset because it would have been on my door.
It was a landmark, and I'm so glad that we got to film there. So we've captured it. So he rewrote it very quickly. I think it's in an hour the scene was rewritten. I just was with him when he just translated the whole thing. And I got permission to shoot at this golf course. It was on its way out business-wise, so it was not very busy. So we got to film there. I think it was a weekend. And you notice the babysitter was there. I wanted to bring her back.
I did.
And make that kind of the joke when we could shoot it in a way that it looked like we were people ask, where did, when I would sit with people and watch it, they would say, where did you find a castle? Where did you do this? Is that green screened? And then when the gag's revealed, they're like, oh, okay, I know where you are now. So that was fun. And that was shot maybe 3 or 4 months after we did the party.
Oh, really? That late?
Yes. And that's where I met Wayne Stevens. I needed to find armor, so some friends introduced me to Wayne. He provided the armor. He dressed the knights. And then, of course, Wayne became the knight in Dead of Night, and we used that same armor.
I thought so. I'm like, that looks like Wayne's armor. I was saying that myself, too. That looks like Dead of Night armor. I got to stop watching Joe's films.
The same armor in the same car, the red Miata, which was my car at the time. We brought all that over to Dead of Night, too.
That was your car?
Yeah.
That's a pretty sweet car.
Thanks. It's gone, long gone now.
Oh, I'm sure it is. It was 20 years ago.
And Dead of Night, we ran out of time. We weren't able to do this, but Dead of Night, we shot on a miniature golf course.
I know.
And we just ran out of time, but I was going to bring the babysitter back.
Oh, no way.
And when he's walking through, we were going to have Wayne as the knight walking through the golf course, and then he gets hit with a ball, and it's the babysitter and two guys.
Oh, that would be hysterical.
We just didn't have time.
You're killing me, Joe. I would have loved that, because that would have made me laugh so hard.
It would have been the kind of thing where it's always funny if you didn't see Laughing Boy, but then when you saw Laughing Boy, you'd be like, oh, God. I really, really wanted to do that, and the production went on so long, we just had to drop it.
Okay, I know I'm not supposed to spoil things, but so I'm not going to spoil things.
It's a 20-year-old film, so it's okay.
I'm going to refer to it as the kissing scene.
Yes.
Did you have fun?
Oh, I had fun doing the whole thing.
No, I bet that kissing scene looked fun.
It was fun. It was, we could just being silly like that, it was fun, yes. And Therese was a real trooper about that.
Yeah, I was wondering that. That was like, how was her reaction? She was like, okay.
She knew, you know, none of this was a surprise. I said, I want to do this. And Therese, I wish she would, I don't know where she is. We lost touch, but I'd love to use her if she's still acting and still around. I'd love to use her in something in the future, too. But she was a real trooper and up for anything.
That's going to be a weird question. Is Sarah Gaydon then your Teresa replacement?
I didn't think of that. Not really.
What? No.
Not intentionally, no.
I'm just thinking. I mean, I think they're both, I didn't see enough of Teresa's work to tell you if she's could be Sarah Gaydon. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I'm just wondering. If Teresa was there, would you have Sarah Gaydon, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, sure. Sarah did not replace Teresa in that way, no.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not like, oh, I need to find someone to replace Teresa. Teresa just kind of fell off the acting map, radar, and no one knew where to find her. And it's not like I didn't seek her out to play like Lars' mom or the detective and join. No, no.
Okay.
I would just, if Teresa were still around, I would find something for her, but she wouldn't replace Sarah, no.
Okay. See, you don't like editing with me. I do look for these things. Why is the film dedicated to the death of Abraham Lincoln?
I just thought it was funny.
It is funny.
No other reason than, let's dedicate the film to somebody. And just thought, let me get one last joke in there.
Okay. So yeah. I haven't.
No other reason than to make people ask why and have a little chuckle.
Okay. I'm going to discuss the cartoons.
Okay.
Because I've kind of laughed that to the end, because there's a lot of cartoons going on. And also, I have a note, the penis joke is very funny.
He just discovered his penis.
Which made me laugh so hard. Because I could see myself telling that joke. And it kind of worked for me. Where's the cartoon idea coming from? Because that wouldn't have been in the play. That's all you.
That was not in the play. That was, again, me trying to break up the monotony of shooting in one location. The play, I added the little bit about, Mike and I are working on a cartoon. It's about all the people I have to put up with on a daily basis. That was one of my little contributions to the script. And I had met, before shooting the film, I had met Ron Neal and the guys at Stone Soup Animation in Houston. And I was working with them a little bit, help, you know, it's just a part-time job. to get by. And when I decided to do the script, do Laughing Boy, I thought, let me see if Ron wants to pitch in and how much it would cost. And he gave me a really great rate. And I said, I'd love to put 5 cartoons in the film. And how much do you need to make that happen? And he gave me a really great rate. And we did it. You know, some people like the cartoon. Some people think they're out of context because they're just, they just suddenly stop. But I think, excited to do it at the time, and I don't regret doing it. I think it's a nice touch that filmmakers don't often do. So I'm really happy with the way the cartoons turned out. Okay. And I'm actually, I'm trying to keep all these films going, and because I may be stubborn, but I don't give up on the films. We're sitting here 20 years later talking about Laughing Boy, trying to get people to watch it. And we made an Atari game based on Laughing Boy 2, which we haven't released yet, an Atari 2600 game. But there's also this fad right now. Everyone's putting out soft enamel pens. And I'm thinking about putting out a pen set for Laughing Boy, but just the cartoons.
Yeah, that would work.
Buying a 5 pen set of the cartoon characters, and the art's already done. So I just need to go into Photoshop and cut them out and send them to the place and say, make pens. Just to keep interest alive and give collectors something and maybe find 10 more people that will watch the film.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, before I run out of time, I got one last question about the film. The donation plate, really? I put a big question mark around that.
I don't remember if that was in the script or not. That may have been something we just decided to do on set.
It made me laugh so hard. It was good.
We had to, and then, I think Sheila put in her credit card. Sheila Sawyer, who was the art department and played Jenny's friend in the film. I think she put in the credit card, which I thought was great. That bit is just really funny to me because it's so out of the blue. There's a live performance at the party.
Yes. I thought that was good. Okay. I made some different questions for you. Since you've been here so many times, I have to make up new ones.
Okay.
It's because you're a video game fanatic. These are all video game questions.
Okay, good.
Because I thought you would like that. Your favorite system.
My favorite system is going to be the Atari 800 computer.
You have to tell me when that came out because I don't even know it.
That was early 80s. It was, I think, it competed with the Apple II Plus. It was more of a computer. It was considered a home computer, not a console. But I look at it as a console now because it was just the games were so great. But if you don't want to include computers in the answer, then the Vectrex would be my favorite.
Again, never heard of it.
I wish I could show your viewers. I could Vect it up on the wall behind me. Can't really see it. Those 4 boxes up there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, I see it. Never seen one.
Vectrex systems. Yeah, that was the Vectrex was released in 82 and retired in 84.
Oh, so it didn't last long.
It didn't last very long. It had only 29 U.S. releases, only 29 titles in the U.S. release. And I've got the whole set of 29. And it's probably got the most active homebrew scene in the collector community aside from Atari. If you're not familiar with homebrews, these are people, programmers who are still making new games for these old systems. And Dead of Night, a video game, was ported to the Vectrex by Lukesoft in Germany.
There you go.
Yes. That was a day when he said he was going to ask if he could port the game over that Jason Santucci made for the Atari, that was a feather in my cap day.
There you go.
Really? I'm going to have my name on a Vectrex game? Yes!
Your favorite game?
My favorite arcade game by far is Crazy Climber.
I've never played it.
It's a 1980. Nichi Bitsu and Taito brought it over to America. It's a side view game. Has 2 joysticks. Each joystick controls one of the arms of the climber. And he's just climbing up the side of the windows of this 200-story building. While windows are opening and closing, people are dropping flower pots and garbage on him, trying to knock him down. There's a bird that drops eggs and poop on him. And he gets to the top, grabs the helicopter, goes to the next building that's 200 stories high. And there's 4 buildings in it, and they get progressively harder. And the 4th building is whether you live or die at the top is completely random.
Really?
If the building splits in two, and there's a signs fall down each side, and there's no way to pass the sign. So if you have to have at least two lives when you get to that point, because you're going to die. If you knock over and you have an extra life, then it's a clear shot to the top. But yeah, it's one of the best games. It's my favorite game by far. And I have one in the garage.
I knew you would.
Actually, I have two in the garage.
I'm not surprised.
I had one, and my friend Brolin knew that was my favorite game. And we, had this Hurricane Harvey last year, when it unfortunately flooded a lot of people out of their homes and ruined stuff. And Brolin found one, a crazy climber, on Craigslist that someone was just throwing out because it got flooded in their house. And he asked the guy to hold it for me, and the guy held it. So I went one night and got this free crazy climber that had been in flood water, but it worked when it dried out.
Oh, wow.
I just got to do some woodwork on it, and I got a second crazy climber.
Okay. Game never played.
Game never played.
What are you looking for, that one game you've never played?
Oh, there's a few, and I'm sorry to have dead air while I think about this, but...
It's a hard question. I did try to think of different questions for you.
Yeah, that's a great question, a game I've never played.
Because you're always posting live videos and this, and I'm like, there's got to be something he's never played.
I've never played Chase the Chuck Wagon on the Atari 2600, which is a rare game. It's hard to find. Yeah. It was a freebie that a Purina Dog Chow put out as a free game. I've never played that.
Are you looking to play it?
I would love to own it. It's not okay. It's rare, but it's still within a reasonable price range. There's some rare games on the Nintendo system that I've never played, like Bubble Bath Babes. Yeah, and that's like a $900 or $1,000 game now, and which I could easily emulate these. I could download it. I could play them on an emulator, but I never have because I'd like to play the real thing. I'm trying to think of an arcade game I've never played, but if I know about it, I've probably played it.
Okay.
Yeah, but I know there's a bunch that I've never played.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Pinball or video games?
You know, I gotta say video games, because I'll spend more time playing video games than I do pinball, but pinball is such a close second. Such a close second. And I have more options. When you play video games, obviously you have more options at your house. You know, I happen to own some pinball machines, but the video game library is considerably bigger. But pinball is so good, and the thing about pinball and collecting is, obviously, every time you play the game is different, because it's mechanical. It's an actual – there's gravity and all science is involved. And video games, a lot of them you can master and beat. Pinball, so many things come into play. You can play the same machine and get different results. You have two of the same machine, two of the same title, and you can get different results depending on how well-maintained the machine is. So there's a lot of factors that goes into what makes pinball great.
So, tell everybody where they can find Laughing Boy, Lars and the Real Girl conjoined.
Well, it's Lars the Emo Kid.
Oh, keep saying the wrong title, don't I, all these years.
All of my films are on Amazon, and most are on Amazon Prime. Laughing Boy, Lars the Emo Kid, Dead of Night with a K, and conjoined. Conjoined, Dead of Night, and Laughing Boy are out there on DVD. Although I'm about sold out of Conjoined and Dead of Nights, so I don't know if I'm going to repress any of those, and then it becomes a collector's item. And Lars the Emo Kid should be available this summer on Blu-ray and DVD. And some of them are on YouTube, some are on Vimeo. If you have Roku, you can find some of my films on Roku. And if you go to starshipfilms.com, a link to all the films on Amazon is there.
That's it. We're done. There's no more. We're finished.
Yeah.
Well, it only took us a year to get here. Well, thank you for your time, Joe.
Thank you so much.
And you have a great day.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.